The annual International Broadcasting Convention, IBC, 2016 is underway in Amsterdam. Stephen Wilkinson, a radio engineer from Sydney, Australia, is here to share his thoughts on DAB+, building AOIP studios, and his own experiences with IP radio studio transmitter links. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. By Direct Current, broadcast e-newsletter. Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday with technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. And by Axia LiveWire Plus. LiveWire Plus includes fully compliant AES 67 over IP built-in. LiveWire convenience plus worldwide connectivity. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host for the show, live from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And I'm here with our guest, Stephen Wilkinson. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Kirk. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could arrange to be here. And thank you for providing the bandwidth.
Well, that's all part of the service.
You know, it's funny. This is the show, by the way. This is the show where we talk about typically radio technology, everything from the microphone to the light bulb atop of the transmitter, so much digital technology. And we're here in Amsterdam for the International Broadcasting Convention, IBC. They hold that every year. It's a big show. It's not, I guess, not quite as big as NAB in the States.
I don't know.
It doesn't feel quite as big. Yeah, but
I mean,
maybe it is.
NAB is big.
It's huge, yeah. So anyway, I got to look at the body count for IBC and see how it might compare to NAB. But we're here for that show. It actually starts in a few hours. It starts on Friday morning. And for us who are here, it starts in 10 hours. I got to be in the booth in about 7.5 hours from now. 8.5 hours. Yeah, 8.5 hours from now. So, all right. We're going to talk about some projects that Stephen has been doing in Australia. We have a couple things from the U.S. to talk about, and we have what's coming up at IBC to talk about. Plus, we may even dish a bit on that iPhone news. Mm. I think you and I have different opinions about that. So I like taking the contrarian opinion.
Well, it's iCult.
iCult?
Yeah.
Well, I don't have an iPhone, so I don't care.
Yeah. But,
all right. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, episode 318. Is brought to you by the folks at Lavo. Hey, I just saw these folks today. Clark Novak is there, and Bill Bennett was a speaker at our SBE meeting, and Bill is the U.S. representative for Lavo USA. You know, everywhere you go, you find touchscreens nowadays, and there's your smartphone like this. There's touchscreens in airline cockpits. They're at supermarket checkouts. They're going to be coming to a McDonald's near you.
Oh,
when they
create your own.
Yeah.
We have that in Australia.
You create your own hamburger?
Yeah.
Really?
On a touchscreen. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been to one airport that had that. You made your own hamburger, ordered your fries and your drink, and a few minutes later, some guy who was really in a hurry rushed your order out to the counter, and you'd already paid, so, plop, and he's right back. I think they have one guy back there cooking everything and delivering it. But, touchscreens are everywhere, and that's because using them makes sense. It's a natural flow it's intuitive, I guess you'd say. Well, you can finish tasks faster and with fewer errors. Isn't it time you brought the power of touch to your audio console? Well, you can, and that's with the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console from Lavo. Now, that's a big name there, Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. So Crystal Clear gives talent an instantly understandable multi-touch interface. They have faders, meters, clocks, timers, talkback, and more than that, live. Well, yeah, they're all live, and they live both ways in harmony on a single screen, so shows run smoother, and they really do sound better. Crystal Clear features Lavo's exclusive Auto Mix. Now, this is so cool what Auto Mix does. This was, I believe, patented, and Lavo ended up getting the algorithms for this, incorporating it into their product. It's a hands-free smart mixing algorithm designed for fast-paced multi-mic talk shows. Now, it also works for music shows where you talk over music. And these consoles have a feature called Auto Gain. You just push a button, and the preamp calibrates automatically while your guest is speaking in the mic. So, your guests can be all over the place in terms of volume. Mm. And if your mic preamp is set too low, you get noise when you try to pot them up high. Or if your guest is particularly loud and boisterous, you can get clipping at the mic preamp. And, there's nothing downstream you can do to fix that.
No.
So, you've got to fix that at the preamp. Well, Auto Gain fixes that automatically. In fact, it with so much advanced operation going on, the talent can dock those mixing controls to the side on their screen, and they can do other things like working with delivery systems, audio editors. They can probably play Pokemon if they want to. That's a bad idea. Crystal Clear's power plant measures just one rack unit. Pretty amazing when you consider the amount of DSP on board, compression, EQ, voice processing, precision delay that can be applied to all of your mic, line, and digital sources. There's some optional upgrades for the Crystal Clear, like redundant power is optional. Matty and Ravenna AES-67, you can get that installed. And all that power really costs no more than you'd spend on an ordinary board. So if you're thinking about a new console, don't decide before you check out Crystal Clear from Lavo. If you're in the U.S., you can talk to Bill Bennett about that at Lavo USA. I'll give you the phone number in a second. You can also go to their website, Lavo, that's LAWO.com. And in the U.S., call Bill Bennett at 888-810-4468. That's 888-810-4468 to find out more. The future is clear. It is Lavo Crystal Clear. Thanks to Lavo for sponsoring this part of This Week in Radio Tech.
They've got quite a big stand.
They do. Well, yeah, they make the huge audio consoles. Yeah, the big, stuff that radio stations could never afford.
Yeah, well, we'd like them.
They're huge. Yeah. But they've gotten into the smaller console business as well. And you know what? Something that I was walking around today, it's still setup day, or it has been setup day. In other words, the exhibitor area is not open to the public.
I haven't seen it yet.
Right. But, you know, I have an exhibitor badge, and so I can walk around and see what other people are setting up. And something in the Lavo ad came to mind as I was walking around. Lavo touts that their DSP engine is one rack unit. So is almost everything else on the show floor. Apparently, one rack unit is the size that everybody wants. Yeah. And I'm walking by stand after stand after stand of equipment, from whether it's intercoms or 4K video digital processors or whatever. Almost everything is one RU.
It's the magic number.
It's the magic. Well, you can't go left. Well, you could do a half rack to the side. Yeah. But have you noticed a trend toward smaller equipment?
Yeah. As you say, most things are one RU. And I guess it's easy to stack it up and add more things as you go along in a rack.
You know, it seems like radio station broadcasters are having to do more and more in less and less space. By the way, I should make sure I really properly introduce you. Stephen Wilkinson here is from Sydney, Australia, and he's also the most valuable person in Christian radio in Australia. Are you living up to your award?
Well, I try. I try my best. I think that was a 2014 award. So anyway.
But you can milk that for quite a long time.
Okay. Yeah, I probably have a four-year term.
Four-year term, okay. Yeah, okay. Have you been able to – now, this is not the most valuable engineer in Christian radio in Australia. This is the most valuable person in Christian radio.
Christian media.
Christian media. Oh, see. Now, I kind of thought there was a guy in the Bible who was the most – the MVP.
Well,
yes. So congratulations on that award.
Oh, thank you.
And so by day, you are the engineer at a station in Sydney.
Yeah, Hope 103.2 in Sydney. The organization is Hope Media. Mm-hmm. We also have a DAB Plus station called Inspire Digital. And
DAB Plus, that's a term that I've heard you use that.
Yeah.
But a lot of folks in our audience, and when you say it, I go, DAB Plus. Oh, he's saying DAB Plus.
Yes, sorry.
Tell us what DAB Plus
Digital
is.
Audio Broadcasting. So it's like HD in the US, but it's runs as a multiplex signal. So it's a multiplex transmitter, and you have multiple stations running off that one transmitter.
So everybody has to get their audio to a location.
Yeah, so it's all muxed together. So,
muxed together. Okay,
yeah.
So if I'm sure they have backups, but if the multiplex signal goes off the air, everybody goes off the air.
Yes, that's true.
And you will also have equivalent coverage areas for all the stations.
Yeah. So because it's the really in essence the one transmitter.
Uh huh.
So everybody's running the same power. It's the same coverage area.
Gotcha. And so you know in traditional broadcasting, radio stations consider themselves a different class of station, right? In the U.S., we have, for FM, we have Class A, Class B, Class C FMs. There used to be a Class D, now it's called LPFM, essentially. And there's translators. And so these vary anywhere from a watt or 10 or 100 to 100,000 watts. And a few stations are grandfathered into like 300,000 watts.
Wow.
So, but in DAB or DAB
signal distribution. You don't have a concept of different power levels, but you do have a different kind of separation of big stations from little stations.
Yeah, so we're a metropolitan community station.
Sydney's a big city.
Yeah, it's a population of 4.5 million people at least, maybe a bit more. We're a metropolitan community station, and and our FM service is 50 kilowatts ERP.
So it's a pretty big station on the FM dial.
Yeah, but the commercial FM stations are 150 kilowatts.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
150,000 watts.
Yeah, ERP.
Typically circular polarized?
Yeah.
So what size of a transmitter are the commercial stations in Australia typically using?
In Sydney. Sydney's one of the highest powered regions, capital cities, because of their topography.
It's hilly.
A lot of hills and valleys, and where the transmitter is located, because it was one of the first cities. Mm-hmm. The transmitters are actually towers are located close to the city, or just a little bit north of the city.
Okay.
So to get out west, you need a lot more power.
West is toward the mountain range.
Yeah, towards the mountain range. Whereas a lot of the other, like Brisbane and Melbourne, their transmitter towers are actually on their mountain range to the west of where they're all
shooting down toward the city.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's part of the reason as well. So in DAB Plus world, because the power is the same, community stations were allocated less bandwidth on the multiplex.
And not RF bandwidth, but bit bandwidth.
Bit bandwidth,
okay.
So one multiplex, I think, is about 1.4 megabits is being transmitted.
So that's all the stations that are on that multiplex have to divvy up 1.4 megabits.
Yeah.
I'm guessing there was a little bit of a political process to who got how many bits.
So because of the power difference in FM, they came to that arrangement with the bandwidth allocated to existing stations. So we got 64 kilobits, and the each commercial station got 128.
Okay. So you got half what they did.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's kind of better. You got a third of their power, although power's logarithmic. I mean, they're not really three times more powerful in terms of coverage. But so back to my question. So for the traditional analog service, the FM service, you said that the ERP of the commercial station is 150 kilowatts. That's more than we're used to in the U.S. for almost everybody. So what size of transmitter is typically used?
They're actually running 20-kilowatt transmitters.
And then a rather large antenna.
Yeah, large antenna.
12 bays or perhaps?
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head with the commercials. But us, as an example, we run a 10-kilowatt transmitter into an 8-bay antenna, which gives us the 50
kilowatts.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, they must have some pretty big high gain antennas to do 150 kilowatt ERP.
And the tower height as well.
So yeah, I remember back in, I want to say the 90s, Continental transmitters came out with some really superpower FM transmitters. I want to say they came out with a 70 or 75 kilowatt.
Wow.
TPO, transmitter power output transmitter. If you didn't want to have such a long antenna, you wanted to use maybe a 6-bay antenna instead of a 14-bay antenna, you could put out a lot of power. Now, of course, the power is expensive. The power bill would be really high.
Right.
And the tubes were expensive for this beast. Now, it's more popular to combine two transmitters of 20 to 30 kilowatt size, and the combining, you get double the power of each individual one. But in Sydney, you typically 20 kilowatt is the FM transmitter size.
So some stations in the past did combine two 10 kilowatts to get their 20 kilowatts, but I think a lot of the newer transmitters are now 20 kilowatts.
Okay. Anybody using solid state at that high a power level, or are they still all a tube transmitter?
Most of them are solid state now.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I'm behind the times. We in my little markets, we get solid state transmitters when they're hand-me-downs. or we just got to buy something, you can't buy a tube transmitter at 5 kilowatts anymore. You got to go buy a solid state. Wow. So it's interesting to compare the differences in the Australian market. Now, I understand that Australia did look at HD radio and decided that it was not the right thing for the Australian market.
I don't really remember the the political reasons why. But from a technical point of view, I think it was decided that ultimately the quality would be better than the HD quality that you have in the US.
Yeah, well, yeah, you could debate, you know, coding algorithms or bit rates, things like that. Mm. Some stations in the US are taking their bits, and if you use every bit possible, I think you can, in the US, you can get up to 122 kilobits per second.
Right.
But most people would you have to apply for that or tell the FCC that you're using this extra bit of space. You more typically have 90 something.
Right.
Kilobits per second, and then you can divvy that up. You know, one of those has to be a duplicate of your FM, your analog, and then the others you could make other. But you can get some pretty low bit rates if you choose to do that.
Yeah,
seems like there's a radio station in a Boston market that is running four different sports channels.
Wow.
At the same time. So that's wow. That's yeah. A whole lot of little several low bit rates in there.
Yeah.
The notion, now with DAB Plus, do you get is there a standard audio codec that's used?
Yeah, so it's the AAC Plus codec.
AAC Plus, or which I think we now call HEAAC, high efficiency AAC.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you think that plays with listeners? Anybody complain about quality?
It really depends on your source material, of course. You know, if you're playing full PCM wave files, which you should really be, it's at 64 kilobits. It's not too noticeable.
to a
audio engineer, you would probably notice things with cymbals and that sort of stuff. But but generally, if it starts out, if the source material is full wave file, it's very good.
We should point out for those, we do talk about codecs here a lot, but we always have new viewers, new listeners on This Week in Radio Tech. Mm-hmm. We're talking about audio codecs that take pure digital audio that's been sampled and digital audio. And typically that could easily be 2 or 2.5 megabits per second worth of data. And we only have 64 kilobits to squeeze it into, right?
Yeah.
So these coding algorithms, everybody knows MP3, right? Well, that was an earlier attempt, a decent one, although now we see the shortcomings of MP3. AAC came along, and then a company called Coding Technologies figured out a way to make it more efficient, basically by having a fake high end. And you know what? If you're listening casually, and okay, almost all my listening is casual, it doesn't bother me. As long as the source material was good and I'm listening to a good 64 kilobit or thereabouts high efficiency AAC signal, I'm okay with it. Now, if I wanted to listen critically to an orchestral recording where it was critical to have a wide dynamic range and beautiful cymbals and xylophones and I want to hear all the overtones of the strings, it's not ideal at all. But if you're listening to Katy Perry while you drive down the road bebopping, then it's really fine. I know some would disagree. That's okay. There's room to disagree. And you know what? As you said, you really want your source material to be of the highest possible quality. And the reason is if you take source material that's already been coded, like an old MPEG-2 music library, which already has artifacts and a reduced signal-to-noise ratio, so the noise floor is already up, and you run that through your audio system, you play it out of your automation, you run it through your audio console, all those things are basically perfect, but you go to coding it again for DAB Plus or for HD Radio, and now you're coding again something that was already coded. And so you're beginning with a slightly inferior audio source, encoding that again, and that's when things do start to fall apart.
Yeah, then you start hearing artifacts, and it just sounds bad.
You hear a lot of that watery sound?
Yeah, and phasey, top end is a bit phasey sound.
Right,
yeah.
Right. You know, I want to riff on this just a bit more because I think it's important. You know, if as broadcasters, we do have a tradition of providing really high quality audio. Back in the 50s, we talked about hi-fi in the 60s. Mm. And then we would always be, I mean, I know of engineers, myself included, who would swap out an older, less capable analog op amp, a chip, an IC op amp, for a better one, right? And the ones that I replaced back in the late 80s, early 90s, now those are passé.
Yeah.
They're not as good as whatever may be available now. And now we have so much digital audio, and as long as digital is handled right, it can be basically perfect. So you can actually take a CD, and you can argue about the quality of how they're mastering CDs. Okay, I get that. But you can take it a CD we assume to be good, and basically the same ones and zeros, the same digital stream on that CD, uncompressed, linear audio, goes into your automation system or your playout system.
Yeah.
Gets played back digitally through an audio console, and except for little level changes that you might manually introduce, you get the exact same ones and zeros that came off of that Katy Perry CD at the transmitter side, or at the input to the audio processor.
Yeah.
And so there has been no distortion. If you can measure the distortion and noise that was added through digital dithering or things like that, it's way down, so far down. Now, you know, CDs are 96 decibels theoretic from loudest to softest, and that's okay. That in 1984 when they were introduced, that was the best we could do. Now we have 24 and even 32 bit systems, and any dithering or mistakes there are way below the threshold of your brain even thinking about hearing this. So I'm sorry, I know I'm going on and on here, but start with the best audio you can, and if that means redubbing your whole music library, then that's what it means. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're playing back stuff that's been MPEG-2 or even AppTex, which is a very professional codec, or MP3 especially, and if a bunch of your songs from the late 90s came from Napster, you know, please replace them with the right stuff.
Yeah.
I've been going on. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. We half of our library was probably MPEG-2. And we've over time slowly been trying to replace those with WAV files.
Do you know what kind of bit rate that was done?
That was at 320 kilobits. So okay. It was pretty.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I know that there were stations at the time that were running like 128.
MPEG-2 at 128 is not
pretty. Yeah, so it started out okay. We did a rough conversion to WAV file to make everything WAV.
But that doesn't fix the audio.
No, it doesn't fix the audio.
I've been actually. I just imported a bunch of music from my own personal library, which is most of it's in iTunes, into a Rivendell system.
Oh, yeah.
And the Rivendell wants to import WAV files. So I already owned all this music typically it was in 256 kilobit AAC, which is pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But I converted them all to WAV files because iTunes will do that for you pretty easily. But I know, you know it, if you're an audio engineer, you know it and I know it. I'm not fooling myself. Into thinking, just because I have a WAV file doesn't mean it's as good as what could have come off the CD, because there was an intermediary process where it was in the 256 kilobit AAC format.
It can actually be hard to find some, going back to the original source material to actually get a WAV file version.
Sure.
Even sometimes now with some new music, it's hard to find. You know, sometimes it is you can only get some material from iTunes to actually play on your radio station. You know, ideally it's always, WAV file, but sometimes you have to make little compromises. But that's where if it is a AAC plus or an MP3 or MPEG-2, and then it goes into streaming or a DAB plus encoding, you can probably really hear.
And here we're talking about keeping everything beautiful and pristine. The in today's modern times, the delivery is still that last mile from the broadcaster or the content creator to the listener. Mm. That's still where it's impractical to deliver a linear stream at 2.5 megabits per second. So that's still where we have to do the compression and get it down to something reasonable. And if you only do that once at the last step, it's not so bad.
No.
It delivers a reasonable quality product to listeners. Very few people are going to complain about the audio. It actually sounds pretty good. And you mentioned AAC Plus again. And I wanted to I won't go through a tutorial, but just mention what happens with AAC Plus. When you do perceptual audio coding, that is, you take audio in, it's digitized, and you have an algorithm analyze this audio. And the algorithm is looking for, okay, what's redundant? What can I remove? What could an end listener actually not hear that I can throw away? By the way, we do have the window open because it's kind of warm here in the flat. So this is Amsterdam behind us right here. Is there any water behind us?
Yeah, there's a canal
that's
can host that.
There you go.
And so there's ambulances, people who've imbibed a bit, probably.
Thousands of bicycles.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you been run over by one yet?
Nearly.
Nearly?
It's just like I was walking today down the street, and it's just like a swarm of bees coming
out. Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
Except they're silent. I never hear them.
And there's a lot of electric cars as well. So you've got to be careful of those. Yeah. They don't run you over. But, there's thousands and thousands of bicycles.
Back to the AC thing. So one thing that becomes clear when you're designing an algorithm is it's really efficient and easy to get the bit rate way down on lower frequencies in the spectrum that we can hear.
Yeah.
So bass notes, mid-range notes, they're pretty efficient in terms of turning those beautiful analog waveforms and digital representations of them into a much lower bit rate. And it's pleasing to the ear. There's really little, if any, problem with lower frequencies. Mm. The problem comes is when you have to characterize high frequencies, cymbals, trumpets, overtones, violin overtones, all that stuff.
All the harmonics that they have.
Yes, the harmonics, exactly, yeah. the overtones. And to characterize those things digitally at a lower bit rate is tough.
Mm.
So the people years ago at Coding Technologies, they endeavored to say, is there some other way that we can represent high frequencies? And they did some studies, and basically what they found, I'll put this in as much layman terms as I can because that's how I understand it, really. You get in the audio spectrum, you get to about 7 or 7.5 kilohertz, and there is very little in our natural world that has a harmonic above 7.5 kilohertz. Most everything we hear that's over 7.5 kilohertz in frequency is a harmonic of something that was created with a lower fundamental.
Yeah.
Right? So whether even if it's the highest note on the piano, is nowhere near 7.5 kilohertz. Mm. You play a violin, all those fundamentals are under 7.5 kilohertz. You could have some kind of a squealing bearing that's over 7.5 kilohertz, and that's really going to hurt your brain. Probably rather not code that anyway. So what they do is with the high-efficiency versions of AAC, they only they only accurately represent the audio that's below 7.5 kilohertz. Now, they still have to look at the overtones, the harmonics. And what they do is that they represent, there's no fundamentals, or almost none, above 7.5 kilohertz, we don't have to code that. We can say, aha, there's some energy at 8.3 kilohertz and 10.9 kilohertz and 12.2 kilohertz, and it's all related to this fundamental over here.
Yeah.
And so we're going to just put some shorthand code in with the AAC code. And we're going to say, hey, when you get to this part right here and you're playing that fundamental, create its harmonics at these upper frequencies. Mm. And those are all they're always going to be an even or an odd harmonic.
Yeah.
So it's easy to say, to very shorthand, just a few bits, to say, play the harmonics, play the second, the fifth, and the sixth harmonic
just
of that thing. Just recreate them.
Yeah.
And so when we say that HEAAC, HEAAC V2, and even the new XHEAAC, when we say they have a fake high end, well, they do. But the good news is it's easy to recreate that. Now, is it perfect? Probably not. There's people who work for the company I work for, Telos, Leif Claesson, for example, is a great example. Leif is such an audio expert, and he is not always excited about what he hears with high efficiency AAC. To him, AAC is okay, but that's going to take 128 kilobits or more per second to reasonably represent all the audio. But at 96 kilobits or 64, 48, even 32 kilobits, you can use this high efficiency version and you get something that to most people sounds good and is not irritating. So I just wanted to give you guys the backstory on what, when we say high efficiency AAC, what we mean. It's a shorthand for the harmonics, and there should be no fundamentals in the natural world over 7.5.
Getting back to sort of IBC, the advantage of me coming to here, to Amsterdam, to Europe, is that it's DAB Plus is a European standard.
Ah, okay.
And so there's going to be, later in the week, there's going to be, or early next week, some sessions on DAB Plus and the future of DAB Plus. So I'm really keen to see what they're going to do and whether down the track the algorithm that they use is actually a more high efficient one down the, so with our 64 kilobits, we'll be able to maybe fit some more audio signals.
You know, I want to ask about that. We've got a couple of minutes before we need to take a commercial break. In Europe, I have been under the impression that they are kind of stuck with the original DAB, which the standard is the MPEG Layer 2 codec. And I, even though you don't want to go below about 128 kilobits, I believe people are, you really want to be at 256. That's what it was designed for.
Yeah.
But DAB Plus, you either what, do you have flexibility, or is it HEAAC?
No, it's HEAAC.
Okay. There's also, isn't there metadata that can go along with it in DAB Plus, album artwork?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, so if you have a radio that has a screen on it, you can have album art or advertorial graphics, that sort of thing. So I think it's up to 8 frames a second you can maybe have. So you, there can
bad
be
for watching a movie, but it's okay for advertorial animation.
So, so there's a whole lot of metadata there as well.
So it seems to me that Australia was a bit late to the party in adopting a digital standard, but that opens up – obviously that opened up DAB Plus as a possibility. Yes, here in Europe, it's
yes. I believe they are moving to DAB Plus. So
okay.
I can't remember what the time frame is. I haven't had a session yet.
I'm sure there's people a few miles away who would know about that.
Yeah, that's right. So
cool. All right. So that, and in the U.S. we have HD radio, and the codec that's used for that is locked in. It's reasonably high efficiency, but it's not necessarily the latest thing
and it's very
available.
Proprietary.
It is very proprietary. Yes.
I understand.
Exactly. Well, it does use that, from my understanding. I'm not sure that anybody's officially said, because it is proprietary, but it does use the high efficiency model on top of a different fundamental algorithm.
Oh, okay.
So it does have the HE part, but it's HE, I think it's HE something else.
Right.
Don't know. I'm not supposed to know. If I do know, I'm supposed to be quiet about that. So if and even if I do know, nobody's going to confirm or deny what I know. So
is it HE ubiquity?
I'm well, we can talk during the commercial. All right. Hey, welcome to our show. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. We sound a bit different than normal. We are actually in an Airbnb flat in Amsterdam. We're here because the hotel that I'm staying at, typical for hotels, internet is fine for email, not fine for Skype.
Yeah.
And and we have to do the show at 11 o'clock at night, and the Rye Center just won't let us in.
No.
11 o'clock at night, they all
They've
go
actually
home.
Got pretty good internet. But
We have good internet in our booth, but I can't be in the booth right now. Shut everything off. So that's why we're here. Also, Chris Tobin normally would be here. He had a family thing to take care of, so hopefully Chris will be back next week. And speaking of next week, I'll go ahead and give a plug for it now. Next week, our guest is a really fantastic engineer. He's from Atlanta. He works for Cumulus.
Right.
His name is Michael Gay. We interviewed Michael's wife at NAB because he's the owner. He and his wife together are the owner of a company called Not a Bot. And they make some really cool accessories for broadcast engineers.
Oh, okay.
So we'll talk to Michael about that next week. Michael is one of the smartest engineers I know. Just terrific guy. So you want to tune in for our episode number 319 with Michael Gay next week. All right, our show is brought to you in part by the folks at the Telos Alliance. And something that I love about Telos is they have a newsletter, and we're going to tell you about it right now.
Not much in the paper today, is there?
Yeah, not much. Seems tough to stay informed, you know?
Like we're missing out on stuff, important stuff.
Yeah, feels like week-old news, yesterday's stories. Half the tech stuff in here seems out of date by the time I see it.
What Kirk doesn't know is I'm way ahead of everyone else around here. Every Thursday, I get this newsletter in my email. It's direct current. The folks at the Telos Alliance publish this.
What Joe doesn't know is I keep one step ahead of the radio guys in this market. Every Thursday, I get direct current from the folks at the Telos Alliance. It's a free newsletter about radio engineering, audio, streaming, studios, everything.
Thursday afternoons, we have our department head meeting. I look like a genius, thanks to the knowledge, updates, and advice in direct current. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell Kirk about direct current. Might help him out.
I wonder if I should let Joe in on my secret. He could use a little help sometimes.
Get direct current in your inbox every Thursday. Read profiles of engineers and newsmakers in the broadcast community. Get technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Important industry news and views. Plus, you'll be up to date on Telos Omnia Axia and ZipStream products. It's all here in the Direct Current newsletter. Subscribe online at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. That's telosalliance.com/directcurrent.
And we're back. Are we on?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good, good. Here, hey, you know, we're using this cheap $14 microphone. And maybe it sounds like it. I don't know. It's hard for me to tell. We're in a flat that's got, you know, flat plaster walls. And, oh, yeah, turn that back. Oh, that's where you're. Okay. So we can hear
yeah,
ourselves.
That's fine.
And we've got the windows open back here. It's really nice weather here in Amsterdam.
Lovely.
Lovely. Yeah. Meteorologist might have some rain Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Okay.
But other than that, it's going to be really, really beautiful.
It's a bit nicer than Sydney at the moment. Sydney's, you know, just getting into spring and it's been cold.
It's been cold?
Yeah.
But it's been hot in Nashville. In fact, in Nashville, we had, depending on how you define the hottest, we had the second hottest summer on record. And if you define that as how many days was the high temperature over 90 degrees Fahrenheit? If you measure it that way, the number of days over 90, then Nashville this year was second only to the year 1954.
Wow.
Where they had actually a whole lot of days over 90. So it was a hot year in 1954. Whew. Now, not everybody had air conditioning back then either.
No.
It was hard to sleep at night that year. So we're at Amsterdam talking about IBC, but Stephen Wilkinson is our guest, and thanks for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech.
Thanks for having me.
Steve, I want to talk about some of your engineering exploits in Australia, because you seem to be involved in a lot of stations other than the one that pays you a salary.
That's right. Because Hope is, you know, quite a bit large community for a community station. It's quite a large station.
Yeah.
And we're a Christian station in Sydney. And there is a lot of little stations, country stations, regional stations, and that are either 100% volunteer or they might have one, you know, manager, and they don't have engineering staff, you know,
or even
a local person they can call on generally. So because we're blessed to have the resources that we have, so I get sent to a number of stations who put up their hand for some help, and I've done a lot of studio refits for stations and with certain brands of consoles.
Well, there's two that are sponsors here. It's perfectly okay to mention. But now this is interesting because you're probably referring to some Axia gear.
Yes, yeah.
I know that you have Axia consoles at your place. So you were an early adopter of the technology of audio over IP.
Yeah, it was 2007, and we were probably about the third station, I think, to put in the Element consoles and systems.
Wow. It's been almost 10 years there.
Yeah, 10 years.
So when you thought about putting in an audio over IP system, did you have trouble sleeping at night? Did you have faith that this would work? Or what?
We actually spent, before we committed to it, we probably spent a couple of years researching, looking at the alternatives, and I just fell in love with it straight away. I could just see that the future, that's the way the future was going to be. And using, you know, with the big systems, using off-the-shelf Cisco switches and, the flexibility in the routing. You didn't need fiber and TDM systems and that sort of thing, which was sort of what the was around at the time. So, tested it and tried it out, and then we think this is the way to go.
You've mentioned small stations. A lot of folks think that audio over IP technologies are for bigger stations. Do you find that you're putting an AOIP in smaller stations too?
Yeah, majority of the ones that I have done installations in are like your IQs and your Radius consoles,
okay,
and that sort of thing. And that can be one studio setup. Most stations will have probably two studios. So depending on funds, and they can put in for grants, government grants to purchase equipment. So they'll plan that we'll put in, do one studio, and then in a year or two we'll do the second studio. And from my point of view, because I've installed consoles in Launceston, which is in Tasmania, the bottom of Australia.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And systems in Queensland, far north of Australia. And the advantage is that when they go, oh, we've got a new announcer, or we need something changed configuration-wise, or we want to plug in an extra source, I can remotely from my office.
You don't have to jump on an airplane and just to go
plug in,
make some mic processing.
Yeah, crone anything, or that sort of thing. So that's the biggest flexibility of it.
That is really, really amazing. And I was just thinking that, you know, 20 years ago, as an engineer, what was I spending my time with? Typically making changes. Mm. Oh, we need for this satellite receiver to show up in that studio now. And I worked at stations that didn't have a routing switcher. And even if we did, a lot of routing switchers, pretty small in the number of inputs and outputs. And so you'd very quickly overcome how many IOs you had. Yeah. And to buy the next size up, well, you had to chuck your old one and buy a new one, or have incompatible systems that didn't talk to each other. It was really bad compared to what we have today.
You know, you had to have stacks of distribution amplifiers and, and you were wiring to every studio separate lines and, that sort of thing. So
mountains of wire.
Yeah. Well, with our facility at in Sydney, we pulled out multi-cores and multi-cores of audio cable. And I tell people quite a lot when they come for tours that I think we've got two Cat6 cables for audio over IP audio, and the rest of the Cat6 cables are all the KVM extenders.
You know, actually, as KVM extenders are the way to go, because they're almost instant. You know, there's a good feel to them. Mm. At my stations, because honestly, we couldn't afford even KVM extenders, because you can pay a lot for those. Sure, you can buy the cheap ones that just flip between two monitors, on a computer. But if you want to put all your automation gear in a rack room and extend all that, we ended up doing the poor man's KVM, which was simply using VNC.
Oh, yeah.
And we were able to design a desktop. I give the credit to a guy who's been doing a lot of engineering work for us, Tom Churchill. Right. He's been on a guest on the show here. Tom has got a great sense of design. So I had a system that was, it wasn't goofy, it was kind of standard stuff, but it was confusing to the disc jockeys, how to select which station I'm controlling, and why do I have three desktops open at once, and is this the real desktop, or is this the one I'm looking at from over there? Well, Tom figured out how to, in a Linux desktop, make really easy buttons. You click a link, and bam, that station's desktop is right in front of you, and it makes perfect sense. No more guessing which desktop am I in here. To the point of when you remote into another computer with VNC, the desktop has the station's logo emblazoned on it. Yeah. So you don't have to look anywhere else to see what station you're on. It's right there as part of the remote desktop you're looking at.
Yeah, we've used like what they call background information, where it shows you what computer it is as well.
And so for a poor man's KVM, it's actually worked out very well. Since we're on the local network, it's quick enough. Nobody's complaining about the speed.
A couple of things to avoid KVMs was we've done is that we also run virtual servers for our office servers, and so we created some virtual desktop machines.
Okay.
And then in the studio for their internet computer to get content off YouTube or looking up the weather and traffic, they actually have a thin client which has RDP on it. And so they just RDP remote desktop to the virtual machine.
And the benefit is it's one less box to take care of.
Yeah. The cost of as you say, KVMs aren't cheap.
Right. So and computers, and you don't want a computer in the room.
Yeah, and you don't want a computer in the room. So instead of having to buy a computer or a server, a physical server, and then a KVM, you've then got a thin client. That might be maybe $400.
Yeah. Now that's an actual piece of hardware.
Piece of hardware that your monitor and keyboard plug into, and that's on the network.
Right.
But then you remote desktop to a virtual machine.
Okay.
The other thing that we've done is using little NUCs, NUC.
Yeah, yeah.
Intel NUCs.
Uh-huh.
So that has a solid state
hard drive. This is typically a $200 computer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In Australia, it's a little bit more.
Okay.
But it has a solid state hard drive in it.
Yeah.
It's fanless. Generally, they're fanless mm-hmm. and everything, depending on what model you buy. Very small and like a bigger than a Raspberry Pi. But,
right,
you know,
right.
But still, they're quite small. You can mount them under the desk.
Yeah.
Desk work.
Right.
And so, yeah, so we install, you know, your Windows on that. And so then that's another alternative without having to use a KVM. And they're very, very fast. Yeah, process.
When you use the virtual server method or the NUC, the little small computer method, what do you do or do you need to get audio in and out of that computer?
The virtual one
yeah.
runs the AXIA IP
driver. Oh, you can run the IP driver in that.
On the virtual server.
And yeah. does it have enough access to its shared Ethernet port to work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. With the NUC, that you can get, they generally have one onboard NIC.
Right, network interface, sure.
But then you can use a USB or adapter.
Right,
if you need
right. a second one.
Yeah, second one, sorry.
Yeah, so I usually would use the USB connected Ethernet adapter for the business network.
Yes.
And use the onboard one, the built-in one for the AXIA network.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
higher performance
Yeah,
there.
Of course, yeah.
Interesting. Okay, I want to see about. So you have actual experience running the AXIA driver,
yeah.
in a virtualized environment and with a NUC. You have that yet?
I don't think we've had to do it with a NUC yet.
I've heard of people who have though, so I know that, that this must work.
Yeah, I don't see why it wouldn't.
Yeah, interesting. I'd love to. I'm kind of a fan of Chromebooks, and I recently bought a Chromebox.
Oh, okay.
And it's $150. And I tell you this, where I live, we have a. A lot of people have this in the U.S. We have a nearby Amazon distribution warehouse.
Oh.
I ordered a Chromebox. It was at my house in 87 minutes later.
Wow.
Yeah. and I had it up and running in 6 minutes, all my account. Some people are accused of being Apple fanboys, and I may be accused of being a Google fanboy. Maybe there's things about Google I don't like overall, but
you're a Chromebook fanboy.
When you log in and you log into your Google Gmail account and everything you're used to is just there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Oh, speaking of remote desktop, so remotely we often use VNC, right, to get into stuff at the station. But I still don't have it set up to work over a VPN. So we have some forwarded ports from our router, and I don't like that. I want to get out of that. Mm. The port forwarding business for something as generic as a VNC client behind it. Now they're on really odd ports. You know, you wouldn't run across them normally, but they're still there.
Yeah.
Security through obscurity is not real security anyway. So I've been looking at Google Chrome's remote desktop.
Oh, okay.
Built into the Chrome browser.
Oh.
So this is really cool. It doesn't offer all the features of, say, TeamViewer, but it's absolutely free. And it seems it seems to work a little snappier than VNC typically does. So you just install the Chrome browser on a Linux machine or a Mac or a Windows machine. You have it logged in to some account you made up. Like I have an engineering account for Delta Radio Network. And the machines just stay logged into that. We don't bother with email on it because we're not looking for email. But then I can, on my machine, I can open a browser tab and say, I want to be logged into that same account, and all my computers are there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's the cost is free.
Yeah.
So
that's good.
I'm sure Google's reading all my emails, but, you know. Anyway, just there's a tip for you. Check into Google's remote desktop. And it works on an Android. It works great on an Android phone. I have an Android tablet, a Pixel C. And it works great on that.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Snap.
Yeah, to look into that.
Oh, okay. So we were going to – back to your exploits.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You were telling me about – there's been a lot of interest in this IP radio STL.
Mm, yeah.
So if you haven't heard, I wrote a little article about how I – it's not necessarily a tutorial on how you should do it, but how I made a couple of different studio transmitter links work with really cheap IP radios from Ubiquiti. There are other brands as well. And certainly you could use a codec with them to put coded audio across. I wanted to try to make it work with LiveWire because we already had LiveWire, and the cost of a LiveWire node at the transmitter site was very small incrementally compared to buying four codecs to go out there.
Yeah,
so talk to me about your experience that way.
So I took it one step further, I guess. A station that I help out in a northern part of Sydney, a few hours north of Sydney, and they had to move transmission sites. So there was a bit of a hill in the way.
Okay.
So,
and a bulldozer was not an option?
I thought, why not? Just, you know. So they couldn't use their current 850 megahertz STL.
Oh, okay.
The STL frequencies in Australia.
In Australia, it's 850. We use about 950.
Yeah. Okay. So we used to a long time ago.
Oh.
They moved us. Anyway, another story. And so the 850 wasn't an option.
Okay.
So they had a consulting contractor, and he had suggested to them putting in Ubiquities, but there had to be a two-hop Ubiquiti link.
So from studio to a middle point.
And then from the middle point to the transmitter.
Circumventing
site.
The hill. Right?
Yeah,
okay.
Going around the hill. So when they said that was the plan, and they were talking about having to buy codecs and things, and I said, well, hang on, person I know, Kirk, has done this with Ubiquiti running live wire.
Let me mention what they were trying to avoid. So, these are becoming so common, these IP links, usually for business, right? They're usually extending internet, or maybe you've got an office in a city and another office 5 miles away and so on, and you want to connect these offices to make your own LAN.
We've even used them for outside broadcasts.
So, to shoot back,
internet connection is 500 meters away.
Ah, okay.
You don't want to run 500 meters of cable. You know, you just use it as a.
So you've got this IP link. So it's almost like having a long piece of Cat 5 cable.
Yeah.
But these IP links are not as stable as a piece of cable.
No.
Perhaps you could say. So you can certainly run coded audio, like AAC audio. By using a Telezip 1 or a Tyline codec or a Barracks codec, and they would be pretty forgiving in that arrangement.
Yeah, even you could even run them at full PCM.
Yes, there's more forgiveness there in terms of the jitter and latency.
Yeah.
But if you want to do like I did and like Stephen, I guess you're moving in that direction.
Yeah.
Really keep your costs low. Have perfect, unfettered audio show up at the remote site. Run your live wire network across that, just the ones that are being subscribed at the transmitter site, right? Okay, so go ahead.
So this was just one station, and it's not a heavily populated area like Sydney would be. So it's 5.8 gigahertz, which is unlicensed.
Unlicensed, okay, same for us.
So, in Australia. So I made the suggestion of running live wire. So I spoke to you and got your paper that you'd written on what worked for you. So I made suggestions to this station that, try and set them like this. I had a pair of my own that, as I said, we'd use for OBs, and I tried to run live wire, in one end of my office or the other, and it didn't work. It was jittery and jumping.
So these were just sitting in your office, right?
Yeah.
Or propped up against the building or something? Okay.
Yeah, and tried them outside in the yard or the backyard, and still it was kept glitching. And so I was very nervous.
I would be too,
about suggesting this to the station. But they were on a tight budget, so that they didn't have the funds to buy a codec. So they set up the Ubiquiti links to the same configuration that you had set up. And so when it came to installing, I took out – they were running using like a Tyline boxes that I'd loaned them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using the link into the transmitter. And then while that was on air, I took out their Omnia 1. So they had an Omnia 1 at their transmitter at their studio, was going – MPX into their
on the 850 system. 850 it was multiple MPX to
all
the transmitter.
Way into the transmitter. So I took out the Omnia 1, took it up to the station, and plugged it in,
You took it to the transmitter site.
Sorry, yeah. Took it to the transmitter site. Yeah,
which, on the you think, okay, LiveWire should be available out there.
It should be available.
Should be.
And the link had been stable for quite some time, so I patched in and straight away came up.
Really?
Yeah.
So, and before, this stuff hadn't really worked at all when you had it on the ground.
No, so I was nervous that it was, you know, going to work.
Prior to plugging the Omnia 1 in, had you, out of curiosity, done any link tests, any speed tests or anything like this from the transmitter site back to the studio?
Oh, yes. I think it was about 20 megabits that they were getting. So,
okay.
And it was comfortably running PCM audio.
Oh, yeah, from the tie line codecs.
From the tie lines.
Right, right. You know, and is that about two and a half megabits per second?
Each way, yeah.
And
they had it in bi-directional.
And so the only difference, and this is tough to explain because I don't understand it 100% myself, the difference between a PCM codec, and tie line does that, most brands do that, Telos stuff does that too, the difference between that and LiveWire is the clocking.
Yeah.
So with a PCM codec, you could occasionally have some slipped frames, and so you would either have the tiniest bit of dead air or a repeated frame, or you could actually miss a few frames because the clocks were catching up. Our friend who's been on the show before, Greg Oganowski, formerly with Orban, described, you know, a man who has two watches never knows what time it is. Mm. And so unless you can absolutely slave one end to the other, then you're going to have this slippage problem.
Yeah.
And it may be once an hour, once a day, or once a month, but you're going to have it at some point. And the hard part about running LiveWire or any other clocked AOIP system is that both systems, clock is going to be pernicious isn't the right word, but it's you've got to have really good connection with low jitter for the clock to keep both ends together. But if you have that, then you have essentially a perfect link.
Yeah, just like a piece of cable.
Just like a piece of cable, yeah.
Yeah, so this station now, from out of their playout system with the IP drivers, all the way over the Ubiquiti link to the Omnia 1 at the transmitter site is LiveWire all the way, and then it's just MPX out of the Omnia 1 straight into the transmitter at the transmitter
site. So from the playout system, from the songs, however quality they are, the exact same, essentially the same ones and zeros that come out of that show up at the Omnia 1 with no interference whatsoever.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, the Omnia 1 does all kinds of machinations to the audio at that point, but that's what it's designed to do.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
It's designed to process.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Very cool. And if you ever need to change, like let's say you have one automation system and a backup one, and the one dies, and you have to go to the backup automation, you could as easily as just remote out to the Omnia 1 and change its subscription.
Yeah, you could.
You could have a program like Pathfinder handle that as well.
Yeah, so that's right.
Wow. Wow. All right. So is it sounding good?
Yeah, sounding good, yeah.
What about the reliability?
It's been on air for at least 3 months
with
the LiveWire, and there hasn't been any issues.
Now, after 4 months, it all goes to heck.
That's what the warranty is.
Well, how's our timing? Okay, we'll go to commercial here in just a minute. I have a few times on this show talked about the two different IP links that I've put up, and they're running 24 hours a day. One of them has two FMs on it, and one of them has four FMs on it. And the one with two FMs is really inexpensive, cheap little Ubiquiti dish. They don't even make it anymore. They make an equivalent now.
Yeah.
But it was both dishes together, and the radios were under $150 or $160. The outdoor shielded Cat 5 cable, a Cat 6 cable, and the surge suppressors cost as much as the radios did.
That's right.
I'll just give you an idea.
Yeah.
That system with those cheap radios, to my knowledge, has never been down for 1 second in now almost a year and a half.
Wow. Okay.
The other system that's running four stations is a little bit more of a challenge because it's that path is twice as long. It's 13 miles long, and it's over farmland that is subject to a lot of moisture collection and fog. And if you know anything about microwave, at 5.86 gigahertz, you get some refractional bending when you have layered.
And that's partly why it didn't work in my office as well.
Do you have a lot of water in your office?
Yeah, that's very well. It's in the bathroom.
So what I was getting at is that we have had a few short outages on that path, typically in the early morning, when even if there's no fog, if the conditions are right for fog, then the conditions are also right for bending of these microwaves. So anybody needs a backup path.
Yeah.
So we found out we can actually get public internet at the transmitter site. So we're going to end up using some low bit rate codecs to go between studio and transmitter. And I'll put in one little good word. Listeners to the show may have heard something about a technology that the TELUS Alliance has through a guy named Hans von Zutphen, who's a resident here in the Netherlands. And it's putting a multiplex signal over IP at a really reasonable bit rate.
Yeah.
Like, you can afford this, bit rate wise. You can afford this. And so we're demonstrating that here at the show. Again, we demonstrated it at NAB. Mm. And it will be a product. In fact, I can't say anything else. But it will be a product. It will be a product.
Watch this space.
Watch this space. So, Steve, we're going to come back with a tip or something.
Okay.
That you can leave people with.
All right.
Something really important.
Pressure.
Maybe something that you've learned the hard way. Yeah.
I mean,
we all have those things. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Axia and the AES-67 standard for audio over IP. Marty Sachs, my friend at Telos, my colleague there, is here to tell you about AES-67.
So Yogi Berra had it wrong. He said, the future ain't what it used to be. Because on the topic of audio over IP, the future is very bright. AOIP facilities cost less, they're faster to build, easier to build, and they really simplify workflows. So AES-67 as a standard was ratified in 2013. At that point in time, a standard was created to be able to interoperate or to be able to share audio between facilities. And that's what AES-67 is all about. Before AES-67, using LiveWire, our clients were able to interchange audio, control, and other program-associated data, as well as advertising information, very easily. So in a LiveWire facility, it's very easy for our customers to be able to find sources, to be able to listen to them, to be able to feed them, and also to be able to have GPIO and advertising information as a part of the network. LiveWire customers were able to interchange audio and advertising information, control data, and also program-associated data from day one of installing an Axia system. But not every manufacturer had that capability. So what AES-67 does is allows gear from our company, for instance, the TELUS Alliance, to share audio information with gear from other manufacturers. And not only that, but it actually gets better because AES-70 has been just ratified. And AES-70 allows, for the first time ever, a standard to exist to exchange GPIO. So we all know broadcasters need closures. Broadcasters need to start and stop equipment. And that's what AES-70 allows for the first time, to have an AES standard that defines how that's done. There'll be some time before that is available in gear. The standard is literally, at the time of this taping, very new, but it's coming. And so that makes AES-67 and AOIP an even more valuable resource for broadcasters. So today, for the first time, you're able to build a broadcast facility from microphone all the way to the transmission processor in fully AOIP. That's the first time that we've been able to do that. Literally, from microphone to the final processor. Even speakers now are equipped with audio over IP connections. So being at the front end, we've worked with partners, we've worked with customers, and we've also worked with competitors. So we have a really good view of what's coming. Here are a few things that we see in AOIP's future. More adoption across a number of different markets. It's not just broadcast now that is interested in AOIP. And we've even seen a manufacturer that's not well known in broadcasting, Audinate, with their Dante standard, now adopt AES-67. We think more choices for broadcasters are better. Through organizations like the Media Networking Alliance and the Alliance for IP Media Solutions, forward-looking broadcast manufacturers are helping to speed the adoption. So Telos is involved in both organizations to help move our industry forward. We're really excited about this. So people who said no to us in the early days when we first started selling AOIP now say yes. They're leaving their TDM and other proprietary solutions and adopting AOIP. The vast majority of people that we talk to every day tell us that they will not buy solutions that are not AOIP based. Clients tell us there's a real difference between AOIP throughout the network and AOIP just at the edges. AOIP is here to stay, and we're excited about it.
Thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance, and they were a very early, they were actually, Telos was part of the committee at AES that was formed to discuss, hey, we need to come up with a standard that lets everybody talk to each other. In fact, and there's plenty of AES 67 around the show.
Yeah.
When you go in the hall, you'll see plenty of that. But
speakers with it and things.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was gonna say. In the Telos stand, we have an audio console. It's a IQ console, and it's got two Genelec speakers, and there is no audio going to them. There's power and Ethernet.
Yeah, wow.
And the Ethernet, it's not, it's standard off-the-shelf Ethernet, and they're plugged into the back of the console has a switch in it. And you actually discover the speakers, then you browse into them, you tell them what channel to subscribe to, and bam.
Great.
This here at Digital is the coming thing.
Yeah.
So you have a quick tip for us about...
Not quite a tip. Today I spent a number of hours at sessions, and it was mainly television-based today. And it was all about OTT, over the top, which is just a way of, if you like, on-demand or streaming of video content to many platforms. And so what I got from that is... radio stations, you're really media organizations now. You're not just radio. You need to be streaming your audio. You need to be, have a good website which has content on the website, which you can have video on that. So, that's something to look at in the future.
How does your station, Hope 103.2 in Sydney, how do you get video clips onto your Facebook page? Do you have a full-time person that does that kind of thing?
A couple of our production people do video content. We have social media person. Actually, my wife looks after part of the social media, as well as the on-air announcers. But also, we actually have journalists that write just for our website, write stories for our website. So they might not even go on radio.
Okay.
But it's important. Content, as they say, content is king.
So... as engineers in radio, we need to be aware of and kind of follow this OTT, over the top. And somebody described to me as if I watch the Olympics on my local NBC affiliate in Nashville over the air, that is not over the top. Mm. On cable, that really isn't over the top either. But if I were to stream over my internet connection NBC highlights or coverage of the Olympics, that is over the top.
Yeah.
Because that's not just plain internet. That's enjoying media that you used to enjoy somewhere else.
Yeah,
over the top of an internet connection.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really
you're not watching it linearly.
Yeah.
In Australia, our rights holder, Channel 7, they had three stations, free to air stations, covering the Olympics, as well as an app where you could select a number of events that were happening all at the same time.
Ah.
So you got to choose on your phone or tablet what event you wanted to watch if you didn't like the three other stations.
Choices. Wow.
So
wow.
I think they had one normal station coming.
Wow.
But yeah. So yeah, they really took it to another level.
Wow. So different than when I was a kid watching the Olympics. You know, there was one channel and you watched what they wanted you to watch.
Yeah, that's right.
As far as you knew, that's all that went on at the Olympics. Whatever they were showing you,
that
was it.
Was only America. That was all you saw, wasn't it? USA all the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Stephen, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad you were able to provide a place to do the show.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And it was a long trip from Australia to here, right?
Yeah, well, it was 23 hours to London and then, about an hour or so from London to here.
23 hours in an airplane.
Yes. Well, there was a little stopover in Singapore, but for an hour.
An hour, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's a long way.
It was 8 hours for me from Atlanta to here.
Yeah, okay.
And you're halfway through a 23-hour flight, and you're thinking, what?
I slept quite well in the second half.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah,
in the second half. All right. Hey, our show, This Week in Radio Tech, has been brought to you by our friends at Lavo, also at the TELUS Alliance, with Direct Current, a newsletter that you should sign up for. And also by Axia and their involvement with AES 67. It is really not just a common thing. It's here, and you'll see it in so many booths at the trade shows, including right here at IBC. We have been live here in Amsterdam. Thank you very much, Stephen, for providing a place to do this.
I was going to say there's a great story in Direct Currents the other week.
Yeah?
Someone was speaking.
So somebody that you know? It was you, right?
Yeah.
Stephen was the subject of a great story in Direct Current. It was about
On your 11 processor, yeah.
But not just the 11. Didn't you have a plug-in?
Yeah, the latest new D-Clipper and GeForce. Yeah.
Oh, you had the D-Clipper too. Yeah. And I haven't played with the D-Clipper yet, just with GeForce.
Yeah.
They haven't given me the D-Clipper yet. Oh, I need to
people.
Got to know people. All right. Thank you for watching This Week in Radio Tech. Remember, next week, Michael Gay is our guest, and awesome stuff. Very clever in how he builds really large facilities. Just amazing stuff. Be sure you tune in for it. Thanks a lot to Suncast for producing this show, this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Appreciate him very much. And also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Watch GFQ for lots of other interesting podcasts, including What the Tech with Andrew Zarian and Paul Thurrott. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.